Welcome to all of you. It has been always a great pleasure to greet you all at our center's programs. In January 1996, we have completed 6 very rewarding years. This is our 3rd international conference, and I feel immensely happy to welcome all the speakers, panelists, and the entire audience. On a somewhat personal note, let me mention that the conference is planned and organized by my son, Prashant, who is an applied mathematician and spends part-time doing research in New York and part-time in Bombay, taking into family business. Ever since his formative years at MIT and Stanford, his interest in art, especially theory of art, has been growing. It all started when I met Timothy Hyman in London, and he very casually mentioned that he will be here around this time, the first months of the 1996. And he said, let's do something for your center. And that gave me the idea to ask Prashant whether he would like to organize a conference for our center. In a month's time, conferring with Timothy Hyman and Geeta Kapoor, he presented a detailed plan for this conference. It seemed exciting and challenging task for us. With the excellent administrative support of my colleagues, Shubhada, Kanchan, and Rupa, soon this conference became a reality. I'm sure with the active participation of all of you, the conference will become a very satisfying and successful event. With this, let me hand over the mic to Prashant.
Good morning. It's my turn to say welcome to the conference. Also, a special welcome to our international guests. It is indeed a great pleasure to have you all here today for our conference, Art Objects in a Postmodern Age. You already know the structure of the conference in the main. We will have 15 speakers and 9 panelists who will be presenting papers over the next 3 days. There will, of course, be breaks and lunch and tea for us to continue the discussion in a more informal setting. There will be a rolling structure, which means that after a participant is done, he or she will become the chair for the next session. Occasionally, we will depart from this setup. Also, on behalf of the Deutsche Bank Bombay branch, Mr. Bernard Steinruck, General Manager, has graciously extended an invitation to the whole audience for tomorrow night, where we will see the art collection of the Deutsche Bank and have cocktails after on the roof terrace. Before I end, I want to express my special thanks to my co-advisors, Geeta Kapoor and Timothy Hyman, for all their generous help with the conceptual organization of this conference. Without their advice, this conference may well have been impossible. I also want to thank Shubhada Patwardhan for her unflagging precision in the physical organization of the conference. I'm very happy that Kumar Shahani, Lalin Jaimane, Nalini Malani, and Chaitanya Sambrani will be joining us as participants for the conference. It is unfortunate that Ghulam Sheikh and Arun Khopkar will be unable to join us on account of their health. Once again, welcome and best wishes for a very stimulating and rewarding conference. I would now like to invite Timothy Hyman to come to the stage for his presentation. He will take an extra 15 minutes or so because we have some more time since Ghulam is not going to be here. So, Timothy Hyman, please. Thank you.
I think we can have the first slide straight away. Perhaps I can just begin by saying that for me, the first 50 years of this century, which I suppose we have to accept is called modernism, is one of the great creative phases of Western art, one of the peaks of Western art for me, and especially of painting. And painters as various as Matisse and Beckmann, late Leger and early Chagall, Mondrian and Clay, Bonnard and Picasso, remain for me probably more relevant than any 19th century painter, for instance, and they remain in my thoughts. And I feel there is a continuity between, I mean, we tend to emphasize the break between the 20th century and what went before, but I think there is a continuity, and I think probably that continuity has become more apparent as time has gone on. But the flavor of the dominating, of the dominant art that I grew up with, in other words, in the 50s and 60s, was, I think, very different from that liberating and various art that existed before. And basically, one's talking about American art, for the most part, and the various warring dimensions of international abstract painting, minimalism, conceptualism, post-Duchampian, which were the dominant, if you like, sects which were around me, say, when I was at art school. And it seemed much more repressive and restrictive than that earlier context. And often the effect of that was to paralyze the image maker with a kind of self-censorship, with notions about what was or was not possible today, with what I thought at the time, and I still think, was a doctrinaire and conformist approach. And that's the period that I think we could distinguish from modernism as being late modernism. And a lot of the problems that painting faces seem to me to come out of that later phase rather than to have almost anything to do with, say, the painting of Europe pre-war. And in general, I've experienced the last 20 years chiefly as a clearing away of those restrictive, late modernist, whatever you like to call them, taboos, as a restitution of various kinds of imagery repressed by that aesthetic. And the three artists I'm going to be talking about initially are, in my view, all of them not really imaginable without the background and the prodding, the necessity to define themselves against the dominant art of the day, in the 60s especially. So I'll be talking about Kitai, and that's a very early Kitai, just after he left art school, Reflections on Violence, about Ken Kiff. And in each case, I will be talking very, very briefly and generally about these artists. I'm not going to be talking in any depth about any one image, but I will be trying to give a sense of the three of them in cameo, if you like. And another one on the left, please. And I'll be talking about the sculpture of John Davis. And in each case, the drawing on the right by Ken Kiff is called Pilgrimage. And this is just obviously an installation shot of quite a wide range of John Davis's work over about 15 years. And that's Barnett Newman standing in front of Who's Afraid of Red, Yellow, and Blue in, I think, 1961. And that's the kind of Frank Stella that enormously intimidated me when I was a student, say, in the late, middle 60s. Now, I think that whole view of art as inexorably moving towards a reduced image is largely what has collapsed. I mean, that's what, when we say postmodern, we partly mean that one-dimensional view of art's development is no longer with us, that the kind of canon that was established, especially by MoMA after the war, no longer holds up. It doesn't look like that anymore. The menu has changed. And I think that when we look back, a lot of what began in shaking that canon was what went under the rubric pop art. I don't think pop art was a good term, like these terms usually aren't, but I think that many of the artists involved in pop were, in that sense, beginning to make a bridge between the artist and society, beginning to talk about the social in a way that hadn't been possible to do within the kind of Greenberg formalist, whatever you like to call it, line that had been established before. And I suppose Kitai, in the early works, is also establishing a view of painting of the image that could include almost anything, and in his case, partly takes its cues from Pound and from that idea of making a heap, that a painting can heap together a great number of various ideas. This is the picture called Specimen Musings of a Democrat. You can't see the individual images, I'm afraid, in the side like that. But there is, I think, an atom bomb, for instance, on the top row middle, breaking out of its frame. And they're jottings, they're notations. They're not floating about in a mind space in the way that perhaps later Kitai would sometimes be, and which perhaps has become the characteristic mode of a lot of what we now would call postmodern painting. But nevertheless, I think something of the whole attitude of creating juxtaposition, very various conceptual references and so on within a painting is very timely, still looks curiously fresh when one sees that painting in the light. But for whatever reason, Kitai was always haunted, and this is where the tension, I think, becomes very interesting, with the idea of another kind of painting that made contact with the monumental, the altarpiece, is what the word I would use, a picture that would have all these ideas, but would still make of them a physical wholeness. And I think that pictures, which are almost the same, I think it's the same year, The Red Banquet. This is one of the many pictures that he, I think, wrongly left out of his retrospective recently. It's in Liverpool. It's a picture about a whole group of people who are invited by the American ambassador, including Marx and Alexander Herzen, to a dinner in London. And it's a lovely image for me of strange moment in history, retold. And as you can see, it also incorporates a text at the bottom, as many, many of the early Kitais did. And today, he looks back on it, and he realizes that this is partly a provocation, that he was partly trying to anger people. And indeed, as late as this, I was astonished when he had his retrospective in London that most people were angry. Most critics were still angry that an artist would append a text to his work. And I think this is significant, that there's a way in which the idea of a painting as a sort of irreducible image is still with a lot of people. And I think they're wrong. I think that painting can engage with the world, and that's partly where I think many of the speakers in this room would be together in this. They might disagree about many things, but they would probably agree that the painting we hope for would engage. That's just the note. So, by the mid-60s, he's producing these very large, this is a diptych, pictures that bring together a kind of stream of consciousness, want of a better word. This is called Erie Shore. It's about the lakeside world of Cleveland, where he grew up. And I think about the pollution. It's a lake that no longer has any form of marine life. And perhaps about wider ideas of corruption, especially on the right. But the effect, oddly enough, of this picture for me wasn't mystificatory. I mean, I certainly can't read quite a lot of what's happening. But it did seem to add up as a vision of the world, as a vision of the mind roving. And that's what remains, for me, marvellous about Kitai at his best, that he does make complex physical altarpieces about where a great deal of complex thought is suggested, is implied. I'm basically just showing one picture from each decade. Now, this is the picture called If Not, Not, which many of you will, I think, know already, which is partly evoking, referring to, you could almost say illustrating, the wasteland. And all these pictures, I think most of you will have heard this before, but Kitai made very early on in his career the wisecrack that, okay, question of illustration comes up. some books have pictures and some pictures have books. And I think that that's, again, a whole area. It's as though you suddenly sort of start breathing again. Yes, there's no, why shouldn't a picture have a book? Why shouldn't a, why did we get it into our head that somehow painting couldn't include literary reference during those 20 years that we were oppressed by these restrictions? Now, at each turn of the road, Kitai left polemics, sometimes contradictory polemics, sometimes comic and almost ridiculous polemics, in my view. And yet, at every point, it was interesting for me. And I was astonished that, faced by this retrospective, so many British critics, at least, simply went for him a year ago. Put the knife into every weak chink in the armor. There are lots and lots of weak chinks in the armor, in my view. And he's a very vulnerable artist. But the totality is so full of ideas and polemical initiatives that he does seem to me someone to be reckoned with by all my generation of painters. At Cecil Court, this is really where he begins to bring in the self much more explicitly in the foreground, and also the whole question of Jewishness, of Jewish identity, which perhaps is the most problematic area. And there are many areas which I find, I've never agreed with the polemic that Kitai initiated in London with Hockney about how art would be saved by return to life drawing, for instance. And that just seems to me a nonsense. But maybe that'll come up later. Another one on the right. And that's a very recent picture, which is in a way a culmination of a lot of strange meditations on Cezanne's bathers. And very, very wayward, and rather interesting, I think, his thoughts about the madness of Cezanne's bathers. But what I'm trying to do in the sequence of slides is to suggest the continuity of a kind of altarpiece premise, a monumental picture that would have a great deal of in it. And that, I think, is what he really contributes to my generation. John Davis is someone I've known for quite a long time, but really known well more in the last few years. And when one goes down to visit him in his studio at Faversham, which is a chapel with about 10 different spaces now, 10 different working spaces, it's immediately apparent that he's someone who collects a great deal of imagery, so that, for instance, his kitchen is just covered in postcards, scraps of all kinds, as well as what perhaps you can't really see, but there are bits, there might be a fork which has somehow, the back of it has been made into a face, or a hairbrush that has been made into a face. There are lots of what you might call animations, none of which he would ever show, I think, but it's play. And so there's this quality of, let's say that, there might be that postcard, and it might be repeated in each room, because he loves the intensity, the compelling quality of Flemish naturalism. And I would call him a headhunter. He's someone who's, I would think, in the course of going around his studio, there might be 2,000 heads visible, either his heads or other people's heads. And it is this quality of the almost hallucinatory power of the human visage that I think he's above all obsessed by, and which is an area almost entirely neglected by modernism. I mean, there simply are very, I can't offhand think of a single sculptor in the 20th century who did that. And it does seem astonishing to me that all that was abandoned, all that possibility, all that compelling possibility. And so, although he admires greatly Brancusi, Giacometti, quite a lot of 20th century sculptors, he would be the first to say that he looks mainly at painting in the 20th century. He doesn't find what he needs mostly in sculptural tradition in the 20th century. And in that way, he's had to define himself against modernism. And in recent years, he's been especially, he's actually now living in Greece, and he's been astonished by archaic Greek sculpture, especially the sculpture that's been dug up in the later 20th century in the Acropolis with the colour intact. And he's found that very illuminating and helpful. And he's very interested in the whole tradition of the effigy which has tends to be sidelined. In fact, some very great sculptors worked on effigies, but a lot of them are in wax and don't survive. But this is the effigy of Henry VII, made by Pietro Torrigiano, they think, who was a contemporary Michelangelo, good sculptor. And it has got this wonderfully compelling quality, and in a way, I think it should be incorporated with any view of the Renaissance. And there are quite a lot of figures like Guido Mazzoni, Niccolò Dell'Arca, who have that quality. Two more. So you might say that he's like many artists of, say, now in their 40s, 50s, 60s, they've had to build up something like an alternative canon in order to find the energy to hold their own work together. Now, his own early work began with these rather creepy sort of monster heads. And one can see that he was trying to find a metaphor for what was so strange in the human face. And he had to find this slightly lurid series of metaphors where the face sprouted an excrescence or became monstrous. And very often, the basis of them was a life cast, which was then, as it were, befouled or given a hideous mark, some of which were perhaps, you know, were less lurid than others. But they had got a wonderfully compelling power. I remember seeing them when I was he emerged very young. He emerged in his 20s. But they maybe, you know, they I think he feels that they look almost like a sort of existential cliche sometimes. That's what his own critique is. Now, I think very difficult transitions. He's arrived at a very different attitude to making the head. For instance, he no longer used the cast. He would try and recreate the head from a memory, an imagination, sometimes even a model, an actual model sitting with him, from drawings. And there's this great profusion of different ways of trying to bring heads together in the studio, many of which, again, have never been exhibited. There's a sort of experimental thing that's going on all the time, over many, many years. And then in recent years, I think he's achieved something very special, which has been almost totally uncommented on. I mean, he does show at Marlborough Gallery, but I've virtually read nothing, no critical comment of any stature on John Davis published in the British press, art press. And I think they have got a kind of humane conviction that is very rare and special, and it's really a triumph to have achieved that. But it's as though people are looking the other way at present. They're just not noticing. So he's someone I feel, let's have two more, someone I feel has come on a very interesting journey. Again, these are his attempts, as a very young man, to make figures that have the same compelling strangeness. He wrote about how he wanted his figures, or his heads as well, not to be like art, but to be more like somebody you met in the street. And that may sound a populist line, but I think he meant it. I think he meant that he wanted it to somehow be like the experience of everyday life in a way that perhaps sculpture had completely ruled out. In making these figures, again, as you can see in the left, he's put strange constructions on those same figures, and he's made them confront one another. But here they're in a different arrangement, and there are various photographs you could show of different ways of presenting these two, so that their resonance is different each time. Two more, and this is the very ambitious sculptural group, which I suppose probably made his name when it was first exhibited. And I think it went to Documenta. That's one of the works that went to Documenta early on, which is called For the Last Time. And again, there are different formulations. You see, the seated figure can be in different possibilities. But again, they're very compelling when you see them. But the sort of grotesquerie is something that I think he would now repudiate. Two more. And a lot of his recent work has consisted of quite small figures, usually chosen from a great profusion of figures. I mean, again, the studio is a much richer and more fecund experience in some ways than an exhibition of John Davis, when he's had to kind of make it all cleaned up in the way that, unfortunately, sculptural installations nearly always are. And I think it's quite an agony for him. You know, how could he recreate the studio in a show? Still an ongoing battle. But again, I think these figures are kind of essentialized in a way that is very sensitive and felt and surprising at this moment. Next two, please. Ken Kiff is actually almost the same age as Kitai, but whereas Kitai immediately achieved fame in his late 20s at art school, Kiff didn't have a one-person show until he was well into his 40s. And I think that that was felt by him as a suppression. I think he felt, still feels, quite wounded by what happened to him. He was marginalized. He was known as a teacher. And in fact, you know, that's a fateful thing in many artists, that his early experience, he'd had some kind of minor epilepsy in his childhood. He'd then gone on to teach mentally damaged, whatever you like to call it, mentally handicapped children. And a lot of his earliest work was about fragmentation, often on a large scale. In fact, when I turn away, can you still hear me? Or is there a problem? Yeah? No, good. I want to look at the pictures as well. the early works were very slow in production, and this was a great problem for him. That there were, I think this work probably went on for well over a year, and probably he only produced another half a work in that year. So when he was trying to produce pictures which were usually tempera on a large scale, this is about 6 foot, maybe a bit more, and also doing all the things that young artists usually do, like teaching and living from hand to mouth and bringing up children and so on, he just found that he was very unproductive. And at a certain point, I think in his mid-30s, he adopted a strategy. And this was that each week, sometimes perhaps each 2 weeks, he would begin a work, even if he would never finish it. And in fact, what he now calls the sequence, which is over 200 works, quite a lot of them are still unfinished. But he would still take them up, even 20 years later. A picture begun 20 years before, he might still take up. And this is the first of the sequence called Something Unknown Needs to be Eaten or Drunk. Another one on the left. And they're small, for the most part. They're in acrylic on paper, so that in a way they're in a very modest medium, a medium that doesn't have the grand altarpiece kind of premises. They're intimate. The touch in itself, I think, is very suggestive of intimacy. They're informal. They're about areas that he would call, and this is a very tricky word, but he would call the area that he would call the feminine. I think he was very conscious of there being a macho strain that he grew up with and which he wanted consciously to refute, which he wanted to suggest that what he would call the feminine areas would be revalidated. And of course, somewhere in the background, which he doesn't like talking about, is psychoanalysis. And the practice of psychoanalysis, by which each week one visits the therapist and presents one's dream material, and the picture becomes, in that sense, a kind of offering each week. I think something of that feeds into these sequence works. Two more. On the left is a picture called Talking to a Psychoanalyst, which is a self image. It's one of the larger ones. It's about 4 foot. Obviously, the analyst is the dark figure on the right. And a lot of his works also suggest this pendulum, if you like, breathing in and out of having a kind of inward journey. This is the picture on the right is called Visiting Hell in a Boat. And then coming up for air and being, in some sense, talking to the psychoanalyst, or, as it were, in the everyday. There's some commerce looking across the whole of the sequence, there's some commerce between dream worlds, archetypal worlds, inner worlds, and the everyday. That's one of the things he said. There are pictures about the street, for instance. Another one on the right. This is just part of the sequence. It's in fact in tempera, but he still regards it part of the sequence. It's called Person Cutting an Image. And so these are sort of self-reflexive works, which I'm particularly interested in. Another one on the left. Not a very good slide. This is a picture which he calls writing. It's rather interesting that he does call it writing. It's clearly somebody painting or drawing, painting, I suppose, but he calls it writing. It's the title. And it's about, I think, perhaps the artist, maybe the muse in the foreground, and the stuff spilling out of the artist's head. And another one on the right. Now, it's not very clear from this slide, but there is a double. Can you see that both the heads there are double heads? There's a dark profile, as it were, and then there's an appendage which makes it into a full face. And obviously, he's interested, very consciously interested, in, for instance, the most wayward kind of Picasso. Those kinds of language are still important to him. And I've recently had conversations with Ken Kiff where he's been asking himself, what is modern? Where are we? It's sort of question. Where are we now? Which is, I suppose, partly the question we're asking in this conference. And he says, for instance, that when he thinks that when someone in the 23rd century looks back at the 20th century, painting the 20th century, they might say that the two dominant elements are the symbol in the 20th century painting and what he calls the elements. Sometimes he calls it forming. In other words, that the autonomous nature of, for instance, a single color or a single sequence of forms is very much more evident, say, in later 20th century painting than it is in 19th century painting. Another one on the left, please. That's quite a large painting where a head has a sort of river flowing through it. Two more. And, I mean, these... just called The Poet. I think it's about Mayakovsky committing suicide. And he's also created fragmentary narratives, which I seem to be still in gestation, about a character, an imaginary character, called the Carpenter. A sort of self, I think, with his shadow. Now, this question of what is the 20th century became very, very vivid to him because he was given for 2 years a residency at the National Gallery, and it was complete trauma. I mean, most things were a trauma for Ken Kiff, but this was really terrible. And the issues that he felt was that virtually none of the curators working in a museum like the National Gallery had come to terms with what the 20th century was. The National Gallery ends now with Picasso. It used to end with Degas, really. But now you've roughly got into the 30s. But very many crucial things happened after the 30s. And Ken feels that for instance, he was outraged that the dominant voices at the National Gallery, the people concerned with him, really admired Lucian Freud and Frank Auerbach much more than anyone he would admire. In Ken's terms, Lucian Freud might not have come to terms at all with these elements of forming of the element of symbol, that it's as though his art sidesteps all that. Now, in trying to confront, say, a beautiful little picture, Patinier on the left, and trying to make it his own, he went through many, many metamorphoses. And in the version on the right, you have this little tiny figure still there. Many of the formulations are there. But he's brought in this sudden figure of Kali, which I think comes directly out of his experience of India when he attended Kasauli camp. It's as though he could only make that image rail again to himself by bringing in this Kali image. That's very suggestive to me. It's as though he is participating in this global thing, almost half-consciously. On September the 12th, 1995, there was a debate staged at the National Gallery in London under the title, Is Painting Out of the Picture? And it was a silly debate in lots of ways. It had Anna Ford chairing it. You know, she is a sort of television personality. And it didn't, in fact, have a single artist on the platform, a practitioner of any kind. But it had curators, an art journalist, comic novelist, a shadow arts minister for Labour government, etc. And it was a futile debate in many ways. But the sort of answers given why painting was under a shadow were, for instance, William Fever said that because photographic and electronic media now dominate the way we communicate, painting has slipped to one side. That's one of the typical reasons, isn't it, I think, given that painting has somehow been superseded by the electronic media. This comic novelist, Kyle Jacobson, said, became very hot under the collar. He blamed a new Puritanism as the motor behind installation art, subordinating the image to didactic ends. Now, all the time, I and I think other artists in the audience was feeling, no, this isn't what it's about at all. This isn't the reason. And what I feel is that mostly the reason is historical, that painting, in one way or another, has behaved very badly in recent years, and in fact, practically since the 50s in different ways, and that the current problems of painting are largely determined by that history. Now, there was a moment, a very exciting moment, in the 1970s when it looked as though all the structures that we'd felt constricted by were collapsing. And in a way, the most dramatic exemplar of this was Philip Guston. And that was the moment when, and I've always thought he was one of the most refined of all the American artists' period, but he suddenly made these still very large, still possibly rather macho, but very fierce self-images, usually of his drinking, his smoking, his studio existence, and also sometimes of kind of contemporary anarchy around him. But I think especially perhaps the self-images are the key ones. And after his death, his daughter, Musa Mayer, published a very interesting memoir, Night Studio, about her father, found various notes of Guston, which Guston wrote in these years. And they're interesting, I think. This is one of them. American abstract art is a lie, a sham, a cover-up for a poverty of spirit, a mask to mask the fear of revealing oneself. Another one. Pictures should tell stories. It is what makes me want to paint, to see in a painting what one has always wanted to paint, but hasn't until now, for the first time. I certainly felt, in those late 70s, that anything could happen. And it was, looking back, it was a great disappointment to me in the 1980s that what actually took place was something almost equally conformist and restrictive, only in a figurative mode. It so happened that what's been called the exile's return coincided with a glut of money. Long before India was liberalized, the West had its own funny money situation. And I think more than ever before in the 1980s, painting became a commodity. And you got painters like Baselitz or Schnabel. This is Schnabel's painting, Iorta, on the left, David Salley on the right, obviously overproducing, a show every 6 weeks. Even Small Fry, my friends, people around me who were, you know, it was a boom market. I think we almost all found ourselves perhaps making more art than was good for us. And I think a lot of the problems of painting right now are to do with that moment, and with the very sudden recession that took place, and a sort of guilt that was there in painters as well as in the enemies of painting. Now, the situation was when that market crashed, there was very little left. I mean, it's as though I think a lot of young artists don't hardly know about the art that was most prominent in that period. And the dealers collapsed. Some of them committed suicide, mine did. and remarkably, the sort of curatorial and art diplomatic switched effortlessly all over the world from New Image, same people, right into installation. And there was a sense that painting had shown itself quite undeserving of its privileged cultural role. Now it would have to struggle with its postmodern rivals, installation, video, text, image, not on equal terms, but handicapped by a disgraceful recent past. Now, it so happened that all the time that that New Image was kind of riding high, I think that my contemporaries, both young and old, were finding out more and more about the early 20th century. They were looking at artists who'd been perhaps at their best in the 1950s, just when they shouldn't have been, if you like. Late Leger, late Beckmann, and producing extraordinarily rich pictures, which had, to a large extent, been lost to sight for some years because of the predominance of American painting, of American abstract painting. And even more fertile proved to be the area from the First World War onwards of artists trying to reconstitute the human image in different ways. Derain, just before the First World War, Carlo Carra, towards the end of the First World War and just after, they both knew one another very well. And there are whole areas of historical discovery that are still going on about that context. And I think it's ugly to talk about postmodern in that way, to co-opt people in that way. But you could say that Derain, most obviously, who'd been through Cubism, Fauvism, Cho is a kind of postmodern figure in that way. He's someone who decided that the kinds of dematerialization, that's what Leger felt too, I think, the kinds of dematerialization of the figure of experience were not really appropriate to his experience. And so he tried to reconstitute the figure. And similarly, Carra, the whole polemic about returning to Giotto, to the constructors, this was fertile, I think, in the 1920s. And I would say one of the big shifts in awareness that went on in the 80s was this extension of the menu to include what went on in the 1920s. Now, meanwhile, I had this odd experience last year of being one of the judges of the only surviving large prize just for painting, which is the John Moores Prize that happens every 2 years. And it was begun in 1957, and it was explicitly meant for young and progressive artists. And in a way, there's a certain piquancy in that, because I don't think we any longer know quite who is progressive. At least I don't know who's progressive, but many people would say that painting isn't progressive anyway. But it's a very, very large send-in. You have to select perhaps 60 works from 2000. And now, on the left was Andrzej Żukowski, and he was the artist who'd won 4 years before, and I very much admired, but wouldn't send in. If you've won the John Moores, you usually don't continue to send in. 2 years earlier, there'd been an artist called Peter Doig, who I also knew and admired. So a lot of people I would have, if you like, backed for the prize weren't there. There was a Ken Kiff, but it wasn't a painting that I particularly liked or felt compelled by. So he didn't win the prize. Another one on the right. And I found myself with the three other judges ending up by giving a prize to a picture that surprises me that I gave a prize to. But it's an artist who was trained at Goldsmiths, which, if you like, is the postmodern academy in Britain, who adopted a very peculiar strategy, a very conscious strategy. Among other things, it's painted in weird pigments, day glow and night glow, so that in fact, the picture changes its aspect in different lights, and that's built into it. The title is Double-Tongued Knowability. Double-Tongued Knowability. And there's a kind of drawing that's going on, the white on the black, which reads as figures, or as events. In fact, later I'm told that they're sexual events, but that is actually illegible. You can't actually read it. But and of course there's a lot of art around which does that. But then on top of it is placed this grid. And Liebman himself, David Liebman, talking about it, he says, "It is my way of coming to terms with the realities of the late 20th century whilst acknowledging spiritual and instinctive behaviour." And there's something rather moving to me about this tension that is there in a lot of the younger artists I know, where they can go so far towards representation, giving, describing, showing, and then they have to withdraw. And I think that has a lot to do with this climate where painting is kind of ashamed of itself. It's got to abstain from anything too corny. If I had to name the picture I liked most in the show, it was the one on the left, which was by an artist called Henry Kondracki. It's called My Uncle David's Last Dive. "My Uncle David loved the sea. He was a great swimmer and was a commando during the war. I would watch with trepidation as he dived into rock pools of dark, cold Scottish water. Sadly, he died of cancer not long ago. When I heard of his death, an image popped into my head of my uncle's last dive into the unknown, leaving Earth behind, floating past the moon, bravely embarking on his last denial of gravity." Another prize winner, that was a prize winner, but not first prize, was Joanna Hislop, who was one of a number of artists who are pursuing what you might call body art, body painting, where you're trying to talk often about the microscopic skin, the pores of the skin, the structure of the body, and making very strange surfaces. I mean, it doesn't really come across on that side, but there are two extraordinarily different surfaces there. The painting's called Seeking and Sought. Light and movement work together to reveal and obscure an elusive presence. And a great deal of painting of, again, of a sort of present climate, it has that quality of elusiveness, revealing and obscuring at the same time. Now, it's characteristic of Goldsmiths, for instance, and I think of art school regimes now all over the world are in place, where the main theoretical underpinning is coming from French theory. And even if there was a lot of post-Duchampian and conceptual art long before Barthes or Derrida really entered people's intellectual, certainly painters' intellectual universe, I think it's true that they've become the dominant, what can I say, well, the dominant textual underpinning of postmodern forms of art. I have an odd line on this, which is that, I mean, it seems to me that those texts, probably the most often used texts, were obviously not written about art, they were written about philosophy and literature, usually 20 to 30 years before the works of art chosen to, as it were, adopt them as their text. And I strongly suspect that Derrida, Foucault, or Lacan, or whatever, would not particularly endorse much of the art being taught, being, as it were, given their pedigree. And this is an anecdote, really, but I have a friend, a very eccentric friend, who works in rural Warwickshire. Perhaps I can say that he lives alone with his mother, who writes Mills and Boone romances. When I said this to Jerry Pinto, he said, "Marjorie Luty." She's obviously a very well-known Mills and Boone romance writer. And one day, about 2 years ago, there was a knock at the door, and in came Jacques Derrida, come to visit him. And this is Simon Luty's account of this meeting. "I described my use of automatism in my own works." This is a picture called The Beginning of Ridicule. I won't say much about it, but they're very odd, sometimes quite large-scale works, where texts, which are sometimes nonsense texts, sometimes rather chaste English that doesn't quite get you anywhere, are put together with a strange sort of private language. And they do add up to some kind of map of the soul, something like that. He says himself he doesn't know whether he's pre-archaic or post-modern. I described my use of automatism in my own work, and we talked about the automatic texts produced by Breton, Éluard, and Suppot in the 1920s. This led directly, of course, to the whole problem of archetype and origin, and I knew that we were not going to be able to avoid philosophy after all. Nor did I wish to, really, although I doubted if I possessed the right language to ask him about that difficult yet fundamental idea of a primal self-cancellation at the origin, a question which was and is, for me, of absorbing interest in relation to both art and life. I remember him saying, almost as an aside, that the metaphysical and moral ideas were inscribed on the brain and on the heart. Well, I think that's very interesting, because when I went into Simon Rutti's last show, a young man who just happened to be there, he said, they're like someone tattooing themselves inside. So that's extraordinary that Derrida comes up with that phrase. The metaphysical and moral ideas were inscribed on the brain and on the heart. Discussion of archetypes led etymologically to topography, and he told me about the innovative layout of his book Glass, with its collage-like confrontation of texts by Hegel and Jean Genet. I asked him about the lecture he had just given at Warwick University on the spectre of Marxism, and I remember vividly one phrase he used, the future faces towards the past. To me, this extract suggested genuine meeting of minds, very different from the doctrinaire Pomo now spilling out of the art schools. When I now encounter descriptions of the postmodern condition of painting, such as Frederick Jameson's, in which the most uncontrolled kinds of figuration emerge with a depthlessness like the free association of an impersonal collective subject, I like to think not of Sigma Polka or David Sally, but of a 55-year-old English eccentric quietly working in rural Warwickshire. Now, all the works we've looked at so far have been, in the last section, have tended to be about a mind space. And on the whole, the kind of space used in postmodernism is this free-floating space. It's not any kind of deep space. And I'm just putting forward the emblem, if you like, of the peep show, of children looking at a peep show, of a minor Venetian drawing on the right, a great fresco by Domenico Tiepolo on the left, where something is being said about the nature, one of the things that art offers, that painting offers especially, of looking into a world. And I vividly remember, for instance, Ghulam Sheikh giving a lecture on Sioni's painting where he brought in Bhupenkaka, saying that in his childhood there used to be a peep show operator coming down the street, and he used to have this street cry. He used to say, "He will show you the world. He will show you the world." And I think that's still a wonderful possibility for the artist. Now, the question is, can, in any sense, fictive space, deep space, illusionistic space, be retrieved from the kind of rejection which it underwent right at the beginning of this century? There's a very interesting recent book come out called The Poetics of Perspective by James Elkins, published this last year by Chicago, where he's asking these questions from a historical point of view partly. He's talking about what a brief moment perspective was, in a sense, sort of really, really rigorous perspective. And then he talks about the rejection of perspective by modernism. And he has very interesting asides. He says, "I consider that it is still largely a mystery what Cézanne put in place of the academic ideals he abandoned." Very shrewd comment, I think. But he then goes on to talk about how perspective has tremendous limitations. We know that. "The eye never wanders," he says, "the eye never wanders as freely and intuitively through a perspective picture as it can, for example, through a crowd painted by Bruegel or a Cinquecento townscape." I think he's probably thinking of the Lorenzetti image there. And he has a large section of the book is about the speculations that have gone on over the centuries about curved space, about the which he traces to Leonardo, to Helmholtz, to Panofsky, the interest in a possible alternative way of structuring space through the curvature, subjective curvature, that you can, if you want to, suppress, but most painting does suppress. historically, and indeed in the 20th century, almost all painting has tended to be planar, has tended to be a sort of grid. Do you know what I'm saying? That tends to be a straight, like a shelf. It's a very, very simplified kind of space that we tend to use. It doesn't tend to invite that sort of entry. I'm contrasting Piero with the kind of Boupin space, which is also the Lorenzetti and the Bruegel space. And I think part of the excitement for me when I first came to India was to feel that in several of those Baroda artists, Boupin especially perhaps, but there was an interest in restructuring naturalistic space in a way that seemed to me to be full of possibilities. One could still, without being in any sense a slave to perspective, one could recreate rich spatial possibilities. Of course, my own interest for a long time had been in the question of how the self could be fitted into spatial, compelling spatial awarenesses. And I found it in some very strange pictures, for instance, by Félix Valatant in the 90s, a great friend of Vuillard and Bonnard, an artist who I think has only recently been really rediscovered, Swiss artist. And Bonnard is a rather a test case. He's someone who was often scorned in my childhood. I mean, I really do remember seeing a great retrospective by Bonnard and being told by people who really ought to know a lot better, saying that you really shouldn't look at Bonnard. He's a retrograde artist, someone who is basically reactionary. And I've come to think they're completely wrong. And I think it is above all the spatial metaphor for the epiphany, for the sudden experience of the self, not a bourgeois self at all, but a self much more like the Proustian self, that makes Bonnard so rich and extraordinary. And when one examines the way that Bonnard lived his life, and I would like to say the way that someone like Boupin lives his life, it's a different model to the heroic avant-garde artist. I happened to read a very interesting essay by an art critic who's often awkward, Donald Cuspid, but sometimes very perceptive, I think. And it's called The Good Enough Artist. And the title, some of you who know about social work and so on, is to distinguish between two kinds of avant-garde artists, who he says, I mean, they're both Meat and Boyce, for instance, and Joseph Boyce. But he says the avant-garde artist who is the re-educator, and the avant-garde artist who is the personist, the exemplary sufferer. And the two can come together, but one way or another, they're both kind of domineering roles. And he suggests that as modes of being an artist, they have become institutional, conventional, instances of pernicious types of modern commissars. And I think he feels that a new kind of personist art is called for. Instead of conceiving art as total transformation, it is best conceived more subtly as a mode of transition or mediation between the self and the world. This is an essay just published last year. And he then goes on to make, which is my last quotation really, two more slides. I think a beautiful quotation that I'd never come across from Ortega y Gasset. And this is the quotation. Circumstantial, that is the mute things which are all around us. Very close to us, they raise their silent faces, as if they needed our acceptance of their offering. We walk blindly among them, our gaze fixed on remote enterprises. We must try to find our circumstance, such as it is, and precisely its place in the immense perspective of the world. Two more slides. And I think that Bonnard, especially in those last works, does give one a kind of relationship to the world that still seems to me exemplary, and is very, very different from the modernist canon that I grew up with. Thank you.
Anyone? Could you elaborate on the notion of the good enough artist? About it, seems like there is some similarity with Heidegger as well, Heidegger's notion of being in the world, this idea of circumstances.
I haven't read Heidegger enough to
Okay. Know that. Okay.
But do you want to know?
Well, no, not particularly, not at the moment. Well, he's being solitary, perhaps.
Well, I think he's trying. Yes, he accepts. I think in that essay he accepts the solitariness, but he doesn't want to make a kind of a fuss about it. He doesn't want it to be an exemplary suffering.
Yeah.
But he accepts that one is. I mean, he uses the word outsider. He thinks the good enough artist is bound to be an outsider. He's bound to some extent to be, to conceive himself, herself, as being not part of some great forward movement or some great cultural adventure, but to be observing in some more reflective way.
This is about elaborating on something a word you use or a notion you seem to hold dear. And that is the notion of wholeness. And you made reference to Kippur, but presumably it's something that you would hold throughout. And my limited knowledge of certainly the modernism you're talking about is that a true unity or wholeness is a really important part of that.
Yeah, it is an important part.
Yeah. Yeah. Although the abstraction that we've got attached to it, I just wondered if you would elaborate on what you understand that wholeness to be.
Well, I mean, in Kitai's case, he obviously is making an art of fragments, but he somehow hopes from the beginning, I think it's there right through his work, that the fragments will come together into a whole. And it's a sort of... Sorry.
Do you mind repeating the question? It's a long question, I know. But many people didn't quite get it. We don't have a mic, unfortunately. If you could ask the question.
Shall I try and
read it? Yeah.
I prefer that question. Well, he was taking up the question of the word wholeness, and he was saying that it's a concept I seem to hold dear. Could I elaborate on what I mean by wholeness? And he suggested that perhaps this had been very important in early modernism. I'd first used it about Kitai. I could have used it about Kenko, because he talks all the time about integration, integrating the image. But that's perhaps another kind of wholeness. I mean, I think the quest for making a fragmentary experience into something unified, which is a picture, which is an image, is very much what I mean. It's a very perceptive question. I think it's very much what I'm trying to talk about. But I think that might be one of the real tasks that painting has still, is to create from the fragmentary. Some kind of solidity of image that can stand for experience. Is that? Do you want to press on with that? Press me a bit further.
Timothy,
yes.
When you speak about Bernard's work as exemplary for you in the context of modernist tenets that you grew up with, it appears as if you are suggesting that, against the modernist canons, Bernard's work stand up. Would you tell us some of the modernist canons that you have in mind?
Well, first of all, the reduced image. Bernard is an elaborator right through his life. He makes literally a great number of marks on the canvas. He makes them over a long period. He accretes. And the sense complexity of perceptual experience, I can hardly think of a parallel in 20th century art. Matisse isn't interested in that kind of complexity of perceptual experience, for instance, is he? He wants a single image. And on the whole, most of us grew up with the idea of an image that was kind of not only reduced, not only simplified, but emblematic. Bonner has got the emblematic, but he elaborates. Kind of relaxes in a way that is very different. And again, I hesitate to use words like femininity, but that is the sort of thing, that's exactly what Picasso accused him of and disliked him. And it's significant that, I think. Bonnard is, I think, the least macho of all the great artists of the 20th century.
And it sets him apart. It's a different spirit.
And therefore he becomes available in the postmodernist space, are you suggesting?
I think so. I think he suggests ways forward. I was specifically here trying to push the possibility of space re-entering art, of actual experience, perceptual space, re-entering art in the 21st century. That's the sort of line I was trying to take. That I think it's, I mean, the whole lecture has tried to be about the areas that modernism rejects, that we, in my view, the generation to which I belong, has partly been about reintroducing those suppressed, those repressed elements. I mean, another theme which perhaps I could have spelled out more in the lecture is the self. The whole question of the self, which is obviously a very vexed question, but I think it's resurfaced fascinatingly at the end of the century. And some of you will know that in last year, the 100th anniversary of the Venice Biennale was celebrated by a huge exhibition put on by Jean Clair, in which, for instance, in the catalogue, it included about 300 20th century self-portraits. And he then asked the question in the catalogue, he said, could it be that the 20th century is not the century of abstraction, but of the self-portrait? Extraordinary question. And it you know, suddenly see a different perspective. Now, ask the question of what the self is, now that's another question. What and why have up to 20th century artists been so involved in the self? And why did modernist canon repress the self? Why has that not been said before more often? Why hasn't that been pointed out more? I think all those are very interesting questions.
No, I ask this question because it appears, I mean, the impression one gets is that modernist canon are not comprehensive enough to include some of the things that
you're suggesting.
I would like to say that in a very limited context, it makes sense to pose a polemic against modernist canon. But if one were to actually look at all kinds of practices which are a part of modernist canon.
Can I say late modernist canon? I mean, right at the beginning, I was trying to distinguish between early modernism, which was pluralistic, various, pointing in all sorts of different directions, and the sort of Greenbergian Museum of Modern Art from the 50s onwards, really, that canon. I haven't brought in the whole polemic that is announced in my summary about the CIA and the because I mean that's perhaps a red herring.
One would immediately think of Jesper Johns and Rosenberg and the whole of recovery of Duchamp right there at 50s because they're all there functioning. So even that gets little,
as I say, pop you could the, which is a silly type name, but I mean, Johns obviously was thought to be part of pop. And in that way, pop was altering things. There's a Duchampian. Marcel Duchamp points in many different directions, doesn't he? But there's a Duchampian art that is about the world. It is about opening up. And there's another, in my view, there's another Duchamp that is quite the opposite, that is almost totally destructive.
Let me make sure if you did say what I think you said, and then I'll ask the question. Roughly, I think you said that the first 50 years were the most liberating years of modernism. Mm-hmm. Then roughly for 20 years, there was a restrictive period.
Yeah.
And then again. So my question is, that isn't it good enough to speak of modern art and not to speak of post-modern art at all? And my reason for this is that elsewhere being where logical positivism was, there is restriction. And then you have the social sciences trying to hit the natural sciences. And then you have the critique of knowledge, which emerged on the continent, before you mentioned in the reader. But more important, the Anglo-American critique of knowledge, Goodman, Quine, Coombs, Rorty, etc. So there we can speak of modern, because modern was restrictive, logical positivism, and then you have this critique. Whereas in art, it was almost the other way around, where you had modern, which was in fact liberative, and late modern, which was restrictive, but of course that was only 20 years, and then we've gone back to modern. So for art, modern is sufficient, postmodern is only elsewhere, and for the elsewhere is going to be dictated.
Well, yeah, I don't know if I finished with what I meant to say about Ken Kiff, that his conclusion was that we are still in the middle of it. He said, if that the symbol, the element, the forming are artists in the early part of the century. So I agree with you. Thank you very much. The good enough mother was a way of telling American mothers not to worry so much. Winnicott, I think, coined it.